Welcome back. You are listening to The Rise Up on CKCU. We're here with James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency and Geography to Nowhere. Hello, Mr. Kunstler.
Hi.
You've gained quite a bit of notoriety for the term clusterfuck. I was wondering if you could begin with telling us what's a clusterfuck?
Well, I didn't invent it. It's really just army slang from, I think, the Second World War, referring to a badly messed up situation that a lot of people are combining to make worse. You know, sort of a too many cooks spoil the broth kind of thing. But, I try to enjoy a little bit of jaunty vernacular language now and again.
So what is the clusterfuck and the long emergency?
Well, I use that term in my blog, you know, which is called Clusterfuck Nation, which just refers to the fact that the U.S. is not really doing anything to change its behavior in terms of how we live in America and the amount of energy we use and the continued suburbanization that's only getting us in more trouble as we continue to make more and more misinvestments. So that's all I'm referring to.
What are the challenges of the coming oil crisis that you foresee?
Well, they're pretty large, and they have everything to do with virtually all the aspects of how we live, how we feed ourselves and produce food and do commerce and trade, and how we occupy the terrain, and how we are going to get around, you know, all these commonplace activities of daily life that we take for granted and have taken for granted for quite a while. You know, just the ability to go into a room and throw a switch and have the lights come on anytime you want them is something we don't even think about anymore. It's just so we haven't been without that for, you know, two or three generations. So, things like that.
And so maybe you can describe peak oil a bit and how peak oil is playing into the looming energy crisis.
Well, peak oil is not a terribly complicated concept. It refers to the all-time maximum point of production in the world for oil. And that time is we're either near it or past it, depending on which information you refer to. The U.S. passed its oil production peak in 1970 with quite a lot of consequences for our economy and for the West generally, as the OPEC nations more or less seized pricing power in the oil markets for quite a while. This is alleviated somewhat by the coming online of the North Slope of Alaska and the North Sea oil fields of Britain and Norway, but those fields are all now past their peak too. You know, when the U.S. passed its production peak in 1970, we were able to compensate for our depleting oil supplies by going to other nations and importing it, and in fact, including Canada, you know, which is our major supplier. But we now import two-thirds of all the oil we use from other countries here in the United States. And the problem with the world peak is that once world production starts to decline, the whole world will not be able to import oil from another planet. So there's one additional aspect of this which is poorly understood, and that's the fact that it's not about running out of oil per se. It's really not about running out. It's about what happens to world economies under conditions where the amount of available oil every year is less than the previous year, and we're in this remorseless state of depletion. And there is a feeling among many of us that that will probably affect badly the complex systems that we depend on for daily life, and that includes, you know, everything from the easy motoring daily environments that we live in, especially down here in the States, to the to the way we things move things, grow things. So you get it.
Because some of that complexity is often lost in just the everyday, just filling up the gas tank or doing whatever you have to do with your electrical needs. And sometimes the connection to how important oil is to our everyday lives is lost, and how that plays out kind of geopolitically in the world of oil. So what are some of the fallouts of this kind of depletion? And
excuse me, some of the what?
The fallout, some of the...
Fallout.
What happens when some of these nations that are really energy thirsty, what is kind of the foreseeable outcome globally, and how does this kind of play out to what's happening in Iraq and even with Iran and some of the showdown in the Middle East?
Well, it's quite clear that we've already entered into a pretty serious state of instability in the Middle East, whatever else you say about it. I would hasten to add, though, that my attitude about what's going on there is not really the conventional, left liberal view of the thing. I don't think that we went there to steal anybody's oil. I think that what the U.S. is involved in there is an unfortunate and tragic and probably unsuccessful effort to desperately try to stabilize the Middle East, mm-hmm. so that we can continue importing all that oil and paying for it, of course, so that we can continue to run our suburban nation. Now, there are a lot of problems with that, obviously. One is that we're not doing anything to change our suburban behavior, and we're going to have to, whether we like it or not. We're simply going to face the reality that we can't continue to live this way. We're going to have to occupy the landscape differently. And it's very unfortunate because we've already made these enormous investments in the suburban infrastructures for daily living, and they're going to prove to be not worth a whole lot in the future. In other words, we will prove to have made a terrible misinvestment. And that in itself is going to be problematical, because we will have this sort of built-in psychology of entitlement. This psychology of previous investment that we've put all of our money into this way of life, and we can't possibly even entertain the idea that we would have to let go of it. So that entails all sorts of problems for us here at home. Now, around the world, there's obviously going to be a lot of conflict, sort of an international contest between the powerful nations over who gets what. We're doing what we're doing in the Middle East to try to maintain the status quo. The Chinese are running around the globe making contracts with all kinds of people, including the Canadians and the Venezuelans and Africans, to get oil from there. And, we don't know how successful their ventures are going to be. The Europeans are kind of just standing by pretending that nothing difficult is really happening, and hoping that they won't be asked to do anything to contribute. But they've been benefiting from the United States' exertions in the Middle East, because they continue to enjoy stable imports of oil through the Suez Canal. So the Europeans at the moment are benefiting, but at any time they could be in a great deal of trouble, because they have almost no oil of their own. We at least have a little bit of oil left in North America. They have virtually none in Europe, so they're pretty much at the mercy of imports. So there's all kinds of potential for disaster. Finally, with Iran, what we have is this Shiite nation, which is making overtures toward moving westward, extending its influence and hegemony into other parts of the Middle East, perhaps destabilizing Saudi Arabia, which has a minority Shiite population, which happens to live, by the way, in the oil-producing regions of Saudi Arabia. And this is something that the United States is very concerned about, is having essentially Iran establish a much broader and deeper sphere of influence which, insofar as they've already expressed a great deal of hostility towards the U.S. and to Israel, you know, we can infer that it would not be a good thing for the U.S. and possibly for the West as a general proposition. So there's all sorts of potential for mischief out there, and it probably hasn't really started because we're just now going over the oil production piece.
And what do you think some of the challenges, you were talking about kind of the problems at home, some of the challenges to individuals and communities kind of understanding the threat in front of us, because it seems that social trends are kind of getting worse. Cars are getting bigger. Suburbs are still sprawling. What do you think the...
Well, the damage is done as far as that stuff goes. You know, I think personally we're really at the end of the suburban building cycle.
But psychologically, do you think that we understand that? And what's barring us from understanding?
No, I don't think we do at all. In fact, there's every expectation that it, and hope that it would continue. And that's, you know, we're going to see that as the housing bubble continues to deflate and that whole sector gets into more and more trouble. The suburban sprawl building economy, which has more or less replaced the manufacturing economy as the engine of the North American economy. So there's going to be every expectation that good times will come back and the home builders can continue for another 20 years building more subdivisions further and further out. But it ain't going to happen. So, you know, however, you know, we have to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, people have to do what historical circumstances compel them to do and dictate to them that they must do, not what they wish to do. And it's interesting to note that a lot of the defense of suburban behavior now, and by that I mean, this economy in the service of building more suburbia, by commentators like Robert Brugman of the University of Illinois, who just published a book called Sprawl,
okay,
which is in effect a cheerleading book for sprawl. You know, these guys try to make the point that sprawl is okay because people like it, but that's a really fatuous kind of argument. And what we're going to discover is it doesn't matter whether people like it or not. We're not going to be able to do it. People are not going to be able to commute those 37 miles from outside of, the asteroid belts of suburbia outside of Dallas or Minneapolis or Toronto. And, you know, they're either going to be able to commute or not be able to commute. And if they can't, they're going to have to make other arrangements. So the whole thing is about making other arrangements. And the great tragedy of the moment, perhaps of the current year, is that the only conversation that's going on around America and Canada about what we're going to do is the question of how we're going to run the cars by other means. And we got to get beyond that, because it cannot just be about how we're going to run the cars. We're going to have to start talking about how we're going to run a whole lot of other things, like how we're going to do agriculture differently, you know, how we're going to feed ourselves, what kind of activities are going to form the basis of our economy, because suburban sprawl is not going to be the driver of that economy anymore. It can't be. Whether or not we're going to do manufacturing, and if so, how we're going to do it, at what scale are we going to do it, how are we going to deal with the existing fact of the suburbs as they currently exist? They don't lend themselves very well to being retrofitted for other things. You know, these are the enormous questions we face. We desperately need to restore the passenger railroad system in both the U.S. and Canada. In fact, ideally it should be an interlinked, connected system, you know. However, we've done everything possible in both of our nations over the last 30 years to destroy our railroad systems, our passenger rail systems, and we desperately need to get that project underway of restoring them. Again, it's terribly important.
It's interesting, when you're in Ottawa, actually, you'll hear probably quite a bit about the light rail system and the debate.
Yeah, I've already gotten some letters about it.
Oh, yeah. I look forward to your comments about it, because it's a very hot issue, actually, and it's a tragedy what's happened in Ottawa with the old rail belts. But I wanted to ask you, there's this kind of painful irony about a lot of your work that, especially when, you know, in classes at Carleton University or even in the media, when people talk about development or the third world, it's often trying to place our development model onto developing countries and on the assumption that there's going to be this amount of energy like we have and everyone's going to live to our lifestyles. And I was wondering if you thought that maybe the energy crisis is kind of a stop block on globalization.
There's an author named Jim Flink who wrote, he was an MIT professor, who wrote some great books about the automobile age back in the 80s and 90s. And he once made the comment that in the future there will only be two kinds of nations, the nations that are overdeveloped and the nations that will never develop in the sense of industrial development. And I think he's correct. You know, I think that what we're going to discover is that the overdeveloped nations will be faced now with the tremendous task of downscaling their economies and all of their activities, virtually. And what we call the third world is going to face a situation where they will simply have to give up their expectations of becoming industrial, you know, nations, because they're not going to. They're going to have to make some other kinds of arrangements for themselves. My guess is they will probably not be nations in the sense that they are today, you know, kind of governmental administrative models on the basis of what the industrial nations are. You know, I think that they'll probably revert to being more or less, you know, tribal regions, you know, and how they will be governed is, you know, going to probably be a lot more primitive than what we've seen. But those countries, particularly in Africa now, have been in the process of melting down for 20 years. And, you know, if you look at places like Sierra Leone, the Congo, and all kinds of places in West Africa, and certainly the genocides in Rwanda, you know, you're seeing really a tremendous chaos as those economies and governments come apart.
That's interesting. I noticed that in a lot of your work, you really escape us present-mindedness, and you talk about kind of the distant future, and which in fact is kind of represented in the name, the long emergency. I was wondering what, if you could describe your theory on relocalization and perhaps some of the social situations we're going to have to get used to in the future here in North America.
Well, I don't go that far out. You know, I'm pretty much confined to this 21st century because I don't think you're...
Which is a lot further ahead than a lot of discussion of politics.
It's not 5 minutes from now, you know. It is a little further. Now I've forgotten your question.
I just wanted you to describe relocalization.
Oh, relocalization. Well, it's not that abstruse. You know, I think that the world is going to become a wider place, a larger place again. I take the opposite view of people like Tom Friedman, you know, the author of that book on globalization called The World is Flat. And Friedman and others seem to support the idea that globalization is a permanent arrangement. And I think that is far from the fact. In fact, I think that what we're going to see is the unraveling of a lot of what will prove to have been transient global economic relations, like the 12,000-mile manufacturing supply lines between Walmart and China. You know, we somehow got the idea that these things were permanent, and I think we're going to be disappointed about that. I think we're going to see the world become a larger place, and people and nations and regions withdraw into themselves by necessity, because we simply won't be able to support those long manufacturing supply networks and food supply networks and things like that. And in the United States, I think that the various regions are going to experience the energy crisis combined with global warming in very different ways. You know, I've maintained that the Southwest, you know, Phoenix and Albuquerque and Los Angeles, that those areas are going to get in rather grave trouble and probably be substantially depopulated because they so far exceed the carrying capacity of just ecologically of where they are, they're going to have problems with water and food on top of the problems that they have with energy and the problems with the suburban living pattern and the problems they have with water. And the problems they have with cheap air conditioning, because there's going to be very little of that.
For sure.
So, you know, that's a problem. The Southeast is going to have similar problems because it's a hot climate. You know, places like Houston, Orlando, they're going to rediscover how difficult it is to be civilized in a very wet and hot climate. And there's a reason that those states did not have cities of consequence until the advent of cheap air conditioning, and we're going to rediscover why that is. The U.S. and Canada could have some very peculiar relations in the years ahead. That we're going to see a lot of trouble with NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the Canadians are going to get sick and tired of selling us all of the natural gas that we want to get from you guys, because you're facing problems of natural gas depletion just as we are. And I think that we are going to get a little testy over the contracts you've made for tar sand oil with the Chinese. And so we'll see how that plays out. There's some grumbling and rumbling around Alberta that they would maybe be more comfortable being part of the Western U.S. than with the eastern part of Canada. That seems a little far-fetched, but you never know. You never know. My own impression about being in Alberta is that, you know, they're sort of psychologically much more attuned to sort of being Denver North than they are to being Ottawa West.
Yeah, a lot of people have been speculating that they'll be leaving the Canadian Confederacy before Quebec does with their oil.
Yeah, well, you get that feeling when you go up there, even though, you know, I mean, there's no overt kind of political mischief going on. You know, there aren't people running around the provincial capital with placards, you know, marching or anything, but you just get a kind of a buzz when you're up there, and I was up there quite a few times this last couple of years, and, you know, so that's potentially interesting. I do think that the United States is sooner or later going to sort of fall into exhaustion and bankruptcy over trying to extend military control over these distant parts of the world. And I think that the United States, one way or another, is going to more or less withdraw into the Western Hemisphere and not be able to exert any or as much influence over the Middle East or any other part of the globe. And when that happens, you know, we will probably lose our access to a heck of a lot more oil. We could lose our access to South American oil. Mexico's oil supply is depleting at a furious rate in and of itself, so that may be another loss for us. So, you know, I see the U.S. being more or less marooned back in the Western Hemisphere with substantially less energy resources than it had before, and a very steeply contracting economy and a great deal of problems. And yeah.
Sir, I was just going to say, on that note, I've seen you write before that you think that there could very well be a more dangerous president than George W. Bush. Maybe you can explain what you mean by that.
Well, I'm not sure exactly about that, if I've said so, as much as that. What I've said is I think that there's enough sort of cognitive dissonance in our culture and delusional thinking and erroneous ideas about what's really going on, so that the American public could develop a kind of wish for more autocratic leadership. But, you know, in that vein, I'd say that if you look at the American public and, you know, to some extent the Canadian public, too.
Sure, I don't make a big distinction between
a lot of the behavior is not that much different. But if you look at how we've behaved the last 30, 40 years, I think what you really... It's hard not to conclude that you're seeing a rather passive and a passive and complacent group of people who have allowed a lot of stuff to happen and a lot of stuff to go too far without doing anything to really make provision for the future. and we're going to be kind of blindsided by events. And at that point, I can see the American public kind of just turning around in desperation and begging for somebody to push them around and to direct their activities in some kind of purposeful way to, you know, to save them. You know, whether it means, you know, putting 10,000 people to work, you know, rebuilding the railroads or what, whatever, you know. I hope that we don't come to a situation where we have a more authoritarian kind of government. I don't think it's going to be George Bush. You know, I think that he's going to be off the scene long before that happens. But there's plenty of room for a lot of mischief out there. I also think in the local and regional level, we could see a lot of action like that too, because one of the features of the life that we face is that anything organized on the grand scale, including large federal governments, may be very ineffective. They may become very incompetent and very ineffectual. And so a lot of the political power may sort of devolve to the lower levels. And as that occurs, there's really no guarantee that it's going to be perfectly, you know, democratic, competent administration at the local level. It may turn out to be very autocratic at the local level. You know, states and even municipalities, you know, are pushing people around under more or less emergency circumstances. So that's sort of what I had in mind when I was writing about those things.
Okay, great. James, I'm going to let you go.
Okay.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Quite welcome.
Great, thanks, James.
Bye-bye.
Bye.